It sounds amazing. And all these producers and executives are nodding their heads, really digging what they're hearing. And then, on the other side of the room, there's the great Michael Jackson with the crappy little transistor radio pressed to his ear, listening to how the music really sounds. Something to think about, wouldn't you agree? Keep one shrimp for yourself. When big companies think small, they harness the power of broke that helped them grow in the first place. Here's an example I took in firsthand, back when I was a teenager hustling my tail off at the Red Lobster. I'd worked there for a couple of years by this point, all through high school and continuing on after I graduated. That's where I learned my first lessons in marketing, customer service, and going above and beyond. It's also where I learned how to stretch my paycheck and find my own way to eat like a king, once I learned to appreciate the great windfall of an untouched plate of food being sent back to the kitchen. But that's a whole other story. One of the things I learned at Red Lobster, just to give you an idea, was that you didn't make your money on the entree alone. You made money on the appetizer, the desserts, and the liquor. Basically, that meant we had to concentrate on upselling the customers. Of course, the company was concerned with getting people in the door, but once they were in the door, we weren't content with just getting that basic $25 average check per customer. We had to squeeze as much as we could out of that customer. That's how the company made its money. The takeaway here is, don't just spend your time looking for new customers. Spend time looking at ways to keep selling to customers you already have. Red Lobster management used to meet with the staff on a regular basis to go over the specials and other programs the company was putting in place. And we got word one day that there was a directive from corporate to cut back on the size of our portions. They didn't want to raise their menu prices or put it out there that the customer was getting less bang for the buck. So they'd come up with a plan to kind of mask what they were doing. What it came down to was a single shrimp. Up until this time, our shrimp scampi entrees would come with 11 or 12 shrimps. And from this point forward, they would be served with just 10 or 11. It might have been a small shift, one stupid shrimp, but across the entire Red Lobster chain, it potentially meant an enormous savings in food cost. It was a great strategy. Even I could see that. But it was not without a possible downside. A customer could notice and complain that he was being shortchanged. But nobody ever noticed, at least not in our restaurant. So the great lesson for me was that the little things can mean a lot. Even in big business, the little things add up. Once I started making my own way in business, I would think back on this little shrimp cutback whenever I read about pricing strategies and other initiatives to squeeze an extra few pennies from a transaction. There was one famous story I came across out of Pocketbooks, the paperback publishing division of Simon & Schuster. It used to be that the default price point for all pocket paperbacks was $2.95, $3.95, $4.95, whatever. The 95-cent piece was the kicker, and it was pretty standard across the industry. But then some finance whiz got Pocketbooks to shift its strategy to a 99-cent price point, meaning that titles would now sell for $2.99, $3.99, $4.99, and so on. Again, it was a small thing that barely registered on customers' radar. But those extra few pennies added up to millions of dollars at the end of the year. Another great example of the stealth approach to business we're embracing in this book. Find a way to grow your business without changing your business model, without alienating your core customers, without taking a big bite of your advertising or promotional budgets, and you'll find a way to win. One shrimp at a time. Be small. Big things in little packages. Linda Johansson James, serial entrepreneur, specialty retail leader. Remember how earlier in the book I wrote about my mother always encouraging me to think big? She was constantly on me to imagine the unimaginable, to think just beyond my grasp. Well, Linda Johansson James is out there doing the same thing, but she's found a way to flip that thinking on its head. Linda runs American Kiosk Management, the largest specialty retail outfit in the country. If you don't know the term, it refers to a relatively new segment of the retail economy, covering all those carts and kiosks we're starting to see more and more often in our shopping malls. The smallest carts take up about 60 square feet of space, but merchants are able to pack a powerful punch on that small patch of real estate. Together with her husband, Max, she's been able to accomplish big things by thinking small, a winning concept that fits well with our power of broke theme. No, she doesn't have the same hardscrabble backstory as some of the other power of brokers featured here, but she's been following an entrepreneurial path from the moment she got out of high school, managing health and weight loss centers, working as a bodybuilding judge, working in the nonprofit sector, launching her own promotional products business, and trying her hand in any number of multi-level marketing programs. But I wanted to highlight her work here for the example it offers other entrepreneurs who are just starting out, and for the light bulb over the head that just might shine down on a wannabe retailer who can't quite afford to open up shop in a traditional store. On that note, get this. 60 square feet doesn't sound like a whole lot of space, but it can be all you need to test out your proof of concept on your product or service. In one location, Linda was able to do over $1 million in annual sales. So size doesn't always matter. But even those 60 square foot spots are now hard to come by. It used to be a local merchant could test out a new concept by renting a table in one of the common areas of the mall without having to make a major investment in a traditional inline store. It was one step up from setting up at a local flea market. Typically, you could rent space for a weekend or a month, maybe for a couple of $100 in a cash under the table way. And at the other end, you'd have some idea if your business might be viable. But that's no longer the case. These days, you can expect to spend between $2,000 and $15,000 for a monthly rental, depending on the size and stripe of the mall and the location of your cart or kiosk. Still a small amount compared to the hard cost of opening a traditional retail space with a long-term lease, but a big nut for some mom-and-pop operators to carry. And you can just forget about grabbing one of those spots for a weekend. Most likely, you'll have to rent for at least 3 to 6 months. The shorter the term, the less say you'll have on where you'll be setting up shop, which means you could find yourself shoved into some remote corner of the mall basement, nestled between a shuttered Radio Shack in a specialty sock store.
Power fact. In 2011, there were 5.68 million employer firms in the United States. 99.7% of businesses had fewer than 500 employees. 89.9% had fewer than 20 employees. The days of these huge corporations and big box giants are coming to an end. And entrepreneurs are finding more and more creative ways, out-of-the-box ways of doing business.
The need for affordable, temporary retail space presented a tremendous opportunity for Linda. At the end of 2015, Linda's company was managing over 1,000 of these specialty retail locations in malls all across the United States and Canada. They're the largest player in the market, earning them a spot in the Specialty Retail Hall of Fame. Yep, there's a Specialty Retail Hall of Fame. So clearly, these small shops have become a big deal. In addition to managing their own locations, they also offer a full slate of services for small businesses looking to open their first location. We provide everything, Linda says. If you want us to help you develop an employee manual, we can do that. If you need help with development, design, HR, IT, operations, we can help you with that. We can give you the full boat, or we could just give you the oars if you already have the boat. Over 800 of these locations are owned and operated by Linda's company. And from these outposts, she sells Proactiv, the number one acne product on the market. It's a concept American Kiosk Management started in just a couple stores, trying to see if the business model worked before adding locations. A power of broke strategy that came about after a hard lesson. See, when Linda's husband, Max, started out in specialty retail, he was selling Metabolife, a weight loss product. He very quickly expanded from one location to 78 locations. But then, he lost the business. Linda says because he took on too much too soon. That's why we look to do that slow rollout when we started selling Proactive, she explains. Whatever we're selling, the ideal is to test it out. Put your foot in the water. Specialty retail is the perfect environment for that sort of thing. If it's not working, there are things you can figure out. Maybe some things you can change. Maybe it's your staff or your location. Maybe it's the product in that particular market. Whatever it is, you can make some corrections. Put yourself in the middle of things. 30 years ago, the common areas and shopping malls were mostly given over to fountains and displays. Maybe some park-like seating areas, maybe a food court. But that all started to change once mall developers realized there was an army of hungry young entrepreneurs looking for a low-cost entry point into the retail market. Back then, the rent from these pop-up shops was like found money for these malls, because these common areas were essentially treated as open spaces designed to give each mall a certain look or feel. Today, however, the rents from specialty retail outlets account for as much as 20% of top-line mall revenue. So you can bet these landlords are taking full advantage of the windfall. As a result, specialty retail merchants have gone from being treated as second-class tenants in the shopping mall hierarchy to commanding the same respect as traditional brick-and-mortar merchants. Let's be sure we have our terminology straight. A cart is just what it sounds like, a portable selling station, usually on wheels, like a push cart. A kiosk is a little more permanent. It's a standalone storefront with freestanding walls, and it usually sets up in a common area in the center of the mall. Imagine a Sunglass Hut, Cinnabon, or Auntie Anne's location in your own local mall, and you'll get the picture. A pop-up store might be a short-term or seasonal rental in a traditional inline setting, perhaps with a Christmas or Halloween theme. We'll only occupy its location for a short stretch, so the store won't be listed in the mall directory, and the build-out of the space will leave it with a bare-bones, no-frills look. But the key to Linda's business is not just scouting out prime pop-up locations. It's developing a line of products that move well in such a tight space. She's tried selling everything over the years, from handbags to sunglasses to Furgles, little furry monster animals that looked a little more creepy than cute. You don't hit them all out of the ballpark, she says, but you learn as much from your misses as you do from your hits. What she learned from her first few Proactive locations was that acne isn't going away anytime soon. And even though the product works, it's not going away for Proactive customers either. It's a one-off business, she explains, using another term you hear frequently in the specialty retail space, as in, I'll just take one of this and one of that. But acne's not curable, she explains. So if you buy one of on one visit, you'll be back 30 days later to buy another one of. By the way, those Proactive kiosks have proven so successful that the company now has several automated selling stations. High-end vending machines placed in key areas and malls, at airports, on military bases, and in targeted store-within-a-store locations. It's a tough business. Most shopping malls are open every day of the year, so there's no chance to hit the pause button. But Linda doesn't mind the hard work, the long hours, the relentless schedule. In fact, she's turned that 365-day schedule into kind of a joke. A twist on the TGIF mantra you sometimes hear in the other workplaces. When Fridays come around, we have our own saying, she tells me. We say, only two more work days until Monday. In the 15 years she's been in business, Linda estimates she's sold to over 50 million customers and that she currently serves over 3.2 million customers annually. What I love about our common area locations is that we're in the middle of all the action, she says. Thousands of people walk by each one of our carts and kiosks every day. With a traditional inline store, they have to be looking for something in particular. They have to seek you out. But with us, they walk by and we have 3 seconds to make an impression. If we're lucky, we get another few seconds to try and make a sale. That's the part I love about the business. Linda says the key to a successful cart or kiosk specialty store is to feature products that you can't find anywhere else in the mall, and to staff her locations with knowledgeable, personable salespeople. "We look for products that are demonstrable," she says. "Products that someone needs another one of and we can have our people demonstrate. Because, let's face it, the customers who buy from you once are the ones who help you build your business when you're just starting out. But it's those repeat customers that help you grow over time."
Linda's key shark point? Do your homework. Listen to Linda and she'll be the first to tell you one of her biggest assets as a manager is her ability to troubleshoot and to find the problem and to find selling opportunities where she never thought to look. One of her latest initiatives offers a great case in point. She's partnered with a company called SolarCity. Now, this is the largest residential solar company in the country. The thing about SolarCity locations is we're not selling anything, she says. It's a lead generator for business where we're setting up in the middle of the mall, where a captive audience is and we can actually talk to them. We're offering all this useful information, getting people excited about the solar, and we're collecting names, phone numbers, and talking to them about how they can save money. Then we're selling them the solar outside the mall setting. I love that her business plan is flexible enough to make room in her company for this kind of creative approach to retail. And it only came about because she studied the market and saw an opportunity. That's what I call outside-the-box thinking in an inside-the-box setting. Another thing Linda learned as she did her due diligence was that more and more mall operators were reporting an uptick in the number of teenage visitors. Trouble was that the kids were in the mall, but they were kind of in the food court, in the common areas. They weren't necessarily going into the stores. So one of the great lessons behind Linda's business is that she found a way to bring the retail experience to the customer. It's like a version of that old adage that says, you can bring a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. Well, here you could bring kids into the mall, but you can't make them shop. So it made all kinds of sense to push the retail experience beyond the confines of the brick and mortar stores and into the middle of the action. Now, can you think of a way to bring your product or business closer to your target market?
Be resilient. Getting back to zero. Ryan Dice, entrepreneur, digital marketer, consultant. When you've got your fingers into everything, it's usually because you've been grabbing at everything. That's how things started out for my friend, Ryan Dice, the founder and CEO of Digital Marketing, one of the world's leading digital marketers. His company pretty much owns the internet when it comes to offering cutting-edge strategies and elegant solutions to help brands get attention online. If that sounds like a tough concept to get your head around, that's okay, because Ryan himself is still figuring it out. When he started the company, just a couple of years out of college, he was determined to build a viable, sustainable business, but he had no idea what that business might look like. All he knew was that there had to be ways to make money online. Somewhere along what he used to call this newfangled thing called the information superhighway. As a student at the University of Texas at Austin, Ryan was throwing darts against his dorm room wall, trying everything he could think of to get and keep ahead of his expenses. He was putting himself through school with a little boost from scholarships and loans, but he realized early on he'd have to put in more time hustling to make money than he would making good grades in his classes. Academically, he was a little all over the place. For a time, he thought he'd go to seminary, maybe become a pastor. He actually studied classical Greek for a semester, but that didn't go too well. "My Greek professor told me I'd made a D in the class," he remembers. Only by D she meant an F. "But she said she'll give me a C if I promise not to go on to the next level. So that's when I figured out I should probably study something else." Remember, there was a lot of excitement over internet startups in the late 1990s. It was the height of the dot-com explosion. And as Ryan sat in his dorm room trying to figure things out, he couldn't help but want in. "There were all these people getting rich," he says. "Even the janitors at some of these companies were exiting with million-dollar stock options." One of the ways Ryan thought to grab at that kind of money was to design websites. The problem with this thought was that he didn't have the first idea how to design websites. So he got his hands on a pirated version of a web design software program and tried to teach himself a thing or two. He started reaching out to every dot-com company he could find in and around Austin, offering to work for free. His thinking was, if he did a good job, maybe they'd throw some stock options his way. "I was completely naive," he says now. "The very first interview I went out on, the guy asked me what could I do, what my strengths were, and I didn't have an answer. I hadn't even thought that far. Never occurred to me they would ask a question like that. I just thought, you know, if I was willing to work for free, they'll let me hang around." His answer? "I don't know." It wasn't a very good answer. Didn't exactly help Ryan make an impression. So he prepped before his next interview. Decided he would start telling people he was a website designer. It wasn't entirely true, but he did have that pirated software program, so he thought that gave him some kind of edge. He thought he could teach himself how to do it once he got the job. Somehow, he convinced an email marketing company to take him on, and he spent the next weekend trying to get up to speed before reporting to work the following Monday. Basically, the company would harvest email addresses from forms and databases and then send out these massive spam-type emails to try to sell a product or service offered by one of his clients. At the time, the company was an industry leader in email marketing best practices, which basically meant that they had an unsubscribe button that actually took folks off the company's mailing list. Other companies, when you tried to unsubscribe, that just told them it was a real email address, so they spam you even harder, Ryan says. Eventually, the company went out of business, but not before Ryan learned a thing or two about web design. But there was only so much he could learn on his own. "I could build a text-based page," he tells me. "I could maybe drop an image in, but the state of the art back then were these fancy flash introductions. There was stuff flying around. I didn't know how to do that, so I was extremely limited." Years later, internet marketers would make a science out of conversion rate optimization and online selling. Studies would show that you get a better response from a simple site, so Ryan's first designs were surprisingly effective. In this way, he kind of backed into his first success. "It's the power of broke," he says. "This was what I could manage, what I could afford. But I just got lucky in being naive. Not knowing what I didn't know wound up being the best thing." Soon, he was designing a website for a lactation consultant and starting to get discouraged. His roommate thought he was strange with all these images of breast pumps on his computer. Plus, Ryan was realizing his dot-com dreams weren't likely to come true. The tech bubble was about to pop, so Ryan knew he wasn't going to get rich just by being in the right place at the right time. This was a concern for him because all he ever wanted was to be rich. That was the extent of his ambitions. As a kid, his favorite superhero was Bruce Wayne. Not Batman, but Bruce Wayne. "I wanted to be a millionaire," he says. "I thought that was a job." Rise to meet it. Around this same time, Ryan met a girl, Emily, and within a couple of weeks, he knew she was the girl he was probably going to marry. He didn't tell Emily that, of course, because it would have been a little creepy, but he filed it away. Started thinking what that might mean. First thing it meant was he'd need to buy an engagement ring. So he did a little research and realized it would cost him about $10,000 just to get something halfway decent. "That's when I started to get really serious about making money," he says. "Before that, it was just a way to get a little something extra to pay for expenses. But now I had this big number sitting out there in front of me, 10 grand. It might as well have been a million. That's how out of reach it felt to me." Ryan knew he would never get to that number unless he took a different approach. So he started thinking of ways to maximize his efforts online. He had no real idea what he was doing, but he somehow stumbled across the concept of bundling, back before it even had a name. Through his own crudely designed website, he started offering low-cost domain names and web hosting solutions, which he packaged together with other tools to help do-it-yourselfers like himself create and manage their own sites. "Everyone was selling web designs," he explains, "but I started offering all these other services too. Hosting, tools, countdown timers. and all of this stuff was available for free, but you had to know where to find it. I had to do something to differentiate myself, and I just wasn't talented as a web designer, so this was a way to plus my offering. He called his website SiteSightings.com, and like his other efforts, it was bare bones basic. The service he provided was right there in his name, the same way it is today, with his digital marketing brand. The site proved popular among other web designers, and as Ryan started to track the clicks, which told him how many subscribers followed his recommendations on all these other tools and services, he had his first real aha moment. He says, I started to think instead of directing these people to other sites, other companies, I could direct them to a product or service that was actually mine, and I could maybe make some money. So he set about it. He came across a simple pop-up builder product in need of a facelift. It had a terrible name, wasn't being sold very well, but Ryan used it himself and found it to be an effective tool, so he reached out to the developer. He didn't know what it meant to license a product, didn't know how difficult that can be, but he made the ask. All Ryan wanted was to sell the product on his website. The developer thought he was trying to buy the product outright, so at first he resisted. So Ryan tried another approach. Essentially, it was a private label deal, he explains, although at the time, he didn't know what that term meant either. The developer could continue to sell it. I just wanted to sell it too. Ryan offered the guy $500. Ryan didn't have the money, but his father had just given him an emergency credit card with a $600 limit. He left himself a little cushion in case he had to negotiate, but the developer didn't counter, and Ryan was in business. Next, he stayed up all night and built a website to promote his new product. He called it the Opt-In Automator, because that's what it did. It automated the process to allow people to opt in to an email newsletter, which had very quickly become a key component of permission-based email marketing. He priced it at $14 and earned enough money in the first 30 days that he was able to pay off that emergency credit card without his father even knowing about the transaction. From there, the product sold steadily enough to allow Ryan to start saving toward that engagement ring. I didn't have any context for generating that type of money, he says now. There was no way I could have worked and saved enough to get there. I had this part-time job with a financial services company, but it wouldn't get me close to that kind of money. I had to introduce a different paradigm. Know what you don't know. By the time he graduated from college, Ryan had about 500 little businesses and products he was marketing online. He was big into ebooks way before Amazon changed the publishing industry with its Kindle. His thing was to figure out what people were searching for on Google, like information on how to make sushi or how to make baby food, and then go out and produce an ebook on the subject. Either he'd hire a ghostwriter to create original content or license existing material and repackage it in his format. He was generating over $100,000 in sales, but he had no idea that this was a lot of money for a college student to be making in his spare time. This, too, is what happens when you look out at the world from a place of broke. You don't know what you don't know. You associate the money with a specific purchase, a specific need, and you don't think of it as a way to fund your life going forward. Ryan says now he had no financial intelligence whatsoever. Money wasn't talked about in his house when he was growing up, not in a practical way. So Ryan was still treating these online businesses as kind of a hobby. I was naive. I thought all adults made like $500,000 a year, he admits. Out of that $100,000, I was probably keeping about $30,000. I was spending money on advertising, on products, on ghostwriters and editors, but it never occurred to me that this could be a career. No way. All it was at first was a way to get that engagement ring. After that, a way to buy a car. And I knew I was getting married, so I put the rest away in savings. He got married a week after he graduated and immediately went to work at the financial services company where he'd been working part-time. Ryan likes to tell people now that he realized the first day on the job he wasn't cut out for it, but he stuck it out until he started learning what other folks in the office were making. That's when it hit me, he says. I could make more money messing around with these stupid websites than a lot of the people who'd been working there for 5 years. So I walked in and quit. Trouble was, he'd been neglecting his online businesses. He still had those 500 or so different web properties, but that meant 500 different businesses, 500 different ad campaigns, 500 different markets. In the 6 months he'd been working full time, Google had made some changes to its advertising program, but Ryan's focus had been elsewhere. Now he looked up and realized he'd made about $250,000 in auto draft payments. $250,000 he didn't have, by the way. I'd authorized those payments, Ryan says, but I wasn't really paying attention. I thought I was just entitled to all this success, but I was spending more money than I was making. It was stupid. And when you're in a spot like that, you're the guy at the blackjack table who's lost four hands in a row and decides to go all in. When you're down, the best way to get back up is to bet more, right? That's the thinking. But of course, that doesn't work, and the hole you've dug just gets bigger and bigger. Eventually, Ryan learned that the way out was to bet small, not big. He pulled back on those 500 sites, cutting his online business to the four or five that were actually making money. Within months, he got to a place where he was able to pay down that $250,000 debt and started earning a living, but he wasn't out of the hole just yet. See, Ryan was so focused on paying off that debt, staying out of bankruptcy, and keeping his family afloat that he neglected to pay his taxes. He was so unsophisticated in this area, he thought that since he wasn't actually keeping any of the money he was making, he didn't owe anything to the government. Growing up, he had no idea what it meant to pay quarterly tax estimates, to set money aside for the government. So when his accountant called him on a Sunday night in April, 4 days before his taxes were due, Ryan kind of freaked. "I now know it's a bad thing when your accountant calls you on a Sunday night before tax day," he says. "At the time, I just thought he must have had a last-minute question. But then I also learned that a phrase you don't want to hear just then is, 'Wow, you sure did have a good year.' I now know that this is not a compliment, not from your accountant on a Sunday night in April." This was where Ryan's lack of financial intelligence kicked back in. And now he was looking at another $250,000 obligation, this time to the federal government. "I hung up the phone and started crying," he says when he shares his story. "It's the only time in my adult life I can remember crying. It was late at night. I thought, I can't do it again. I just finished paying off that last $250,000, and I've been beaten down by that, and I couldn't see any way out of this. And it's not like I've been spending all this money on Lamborghinis, hookers, and blow. I wasn't living the life of a rock star. I just wasn't paying attention. I was putting the money back into the business, paying off that debt. There was next to nothing in the bank. I didn't know you had to pay taxes if you spend all the money, but apparently you do." It took a reality check from his wife, Emily, to set him straight. He told her what had happened, and she said, "I don't know why you're freaking out so much. You'll figure it out. You always do." End of the story. Ryan gave himself 24 hours to mope. Then he pulled another all-nighter that Monday and created promotional campaigns for the six primary businesses he had going at the time. In sum, he was transparent about his situation, told his customers he owed a bunch of money to the IRS and could really use their support. Then he woke up late the next morning and saw he'd generated about $80,000 in revenue just from these desperation appeals. That figured double by the end of the day. And 2 days later, on April 15, he was able to cut a check for the full amount he owed to the government. But that's not really the end of the story, is it? No, because it was out of his low moment that Ryan finally harnessed the power of broke and put it to work in a long-term way. He'd seen that when his back was against the wall, he could use that wall to prop himself up. He could push off that wall and start moving forward. It took a couple of times for the lesson to register. But once he was able to meet this surprise tax obligation that shouldn't have taken him by surprise, he had a whole new outlook. In fact, a couple of days later, Ryan cut another check to the government. This one was to cover the money he just generated to pay off his tax bill. "I was finally at zero," he says, "and zero felt really, really good."
Ryan's key shark point, set a goal. With Ryan, the front end of his career was all about setting incremental goals. First, he needed to scratch his way to $10,000 so he could buy his girlfriend an engagement ring. Next, he needed $250,000 to pay off those advertising fees that had kind of run away from him. After that, he needed another $250,000 to dig himself out of the hole he jumped into with the IRS. But each time, he was out to hit a very specific target. And as he grew his line of products and services, those targets kept moving. But once he trusted that he could hit those targets, he freed himself to start thinking about actually building a business. Here's the thing about goals. You can't hit a target that you can't see. At each step of the journey, Ryan was able to keep his target in sight. Yeah, they kept changing on him, but he was able to keep his focus. That's something that we all need to keep in mind as we move our businesses forward. So, tell me, what's your next target?
Be visionary. Own your own style. Lauren Reidinger, fashion trendsetter, internet retailer. The thing that struck me about Lauren Reidinger's story when I met her was how she and her husband worked in service of one big idea when they were first starting out. They didn't have any money. In fact, Lauren's husband, JR, was just coming out of bankruptcy when they first met. But together, they had an idea that the internet was going to change the way America shopped. Now, this might not seem like such a big idea today, but you have to remember that these two started their company, Market America, all the way back in 1991, when most people didn't have computers. That was the Stone Age, right? Sites like Amazon and eBay were still a couple years away, and the only way for most people to get online was through dial-up services like AOL and Prodigy. So the concept of people shopping online was all the way out there. Really, it was a game changer, but it was a game Lauren believed she was destined to play. Why? Because she could close her eyes and picture it. Because she could see into the future and imagine a completely different type of shopping experience. Her determination reminds me of one of my favorite quotes. If people aren't laughing at your dreams, then you're not dreaming big enough. It's a great line, don't you think? I wish I knew who came up with that line, so I could give credit where credit is due. But I use it all the time. Here, Lauren must have felt like she was walking into a wind machine. Even the people closest to her thought she was nuts, pursuing this wild idea. Maybe they weren't laughing at her, but they were certainly scratching their heads. But Lauren and JR saw something the rest of us weren't seeing just yet, and they were committed to bringing other people in on their vision. See, JR had been an Amway distributor, so he had experience with multi-level marketing. That's a controversial phrase to some people. It refers to a selling model that pays salespeople not only for their sales they generate, but also for sales generated by the people they recruit. That's how it works at companies like Amway and Avon. But even though Lauren and JR resisted the term, they knew that for their idea to work, they'd need to try out some of the time-tested tools of direct door-to-door type selling in the untested waters of online shopping. They trusted the internet to provide an unprecedented selling opportunity, but they didn't trust the American public to get online and start shopping without some kind of push. Basically, they believed they needed an army of individual entrepreneurs to supplement the reach and power of this new global marketing machine, a machine most people didn't have, back when personal computers were still coming on the scene. People were already shopping at home, Lauren explains. The home shopping network, QVC, they'd been around for a while by this point, so it wasn't such a big leap. That whole home shopping phenomenon was a big deal, but it hadn't gone electronic, not yet. So the only leap, really, was how much time people would be spending online. The big idea behind Market America was that it would offer more than a simple listing of available products. To Lauren's thinking, this much was a given. The plan was for customers to hear directly from local sales reps with testimonials, demonstrations, and special offers. The local reps would take a hefty commission cut, but Lauren hoped to recruit thousands of reps to help her get the word out in a traditional way, and then maybe drive customers to make their first online purchases. We knew we'd had to rely on word of mouth to get our products out there, Lauren says. Today, it's so much easier to do that through social media and so many other forms of advertising that don't really cost any money. But back then, we didn't have all that. It took blood, sweat, and tears to build a brand. We didn't have that amplifier. We had to get out there and tell people what we were about, almost in a hand-selling way. Market America didn't even have a product to sell at first. That's what folks used to call putting the cart before the horse. All they had was a primitive website, and even that took some doing. Lauren had no background in web design, and neither did her husband. So she reached out to a few high school friends who knew something about computers and invited them over. We had two people in the kitchen, she says, five people in the living room. We set up shop all over the house. It took forever, because for a long time they were working off of just one computer. For their first product, Lauren found a topical cream to help you quit smoking. The only problem? She wasn't sure it worked. And as it turned out, it didn't. It supposedly had all these magic ingredients, she remembers, and the manufacturer had all this research to back up his claims, and people really wanted it to work. Psychologically, the world was ready for a non-smoking cream. People were willing to try anything, but this cream wasn't the answer.
Power fact. For almost all retailers, inventory is the single largest asset on their balance sheet. But in most cases, it's also the least productive asset. That's why it was so important for Lauren and her Market America team to bring in their first products at the lowest possible cost. And that's why it was so important for Lauren and her Market America team to bring in their first products at the lowest possible cost. And that's why it's also important for you to find a way to do the same thing.
The good news here was that Market America had been able to license the product at no cost, because it was the manufacturer's first product too. So Lauren and JR weren't really out any money. Just a bit of momentum and credibility, two things they didn't really have to spare. But Lauren felt they could get them back in time. And they got their first failure out of the way. Always a silver lining when you're just starting out. It was an important stepping stone for us, Lauren says. Failing is a part of succeeding. Hire from within. Early on, the only people Lauren and JR could afford to hire were friends and family members. Both of Lauren's brothers came to work for her before the website launched, and all she could afford to pay them was $50 a week for gas money. They slept on Lauren's couch, grabbed what they could find in Lauren's fridge, earned themselves a ton of goodwill and good karma, and not much else, all because they believed in the concept of internet selling. Essentially, Market America brought people in on the come, the default move for a lot of startups that can't afford to bring people on at full salary. It was a leap of faith for everybody, Lauren says now. I couldn't even show them my ideas for the company on a computer. I had to sketch it out for them on a notepad. But once they got it, they got it. People loved the concept. They could see there was an opportunity here, and they were willing to work for it. The great takeaway for Lauren and JR after that first failure was to look beyond the manufacturer's claims. They knew their next product had to really deliver on its promise if they hoped to gain back some of what they'd lost. Happily, they came across a weight loss supplement called Thermochrome, and which continues to be one of their best-selling products. Lauren had a deep interest in nutritional and wellness products, and she was thrilled to have a chance to bring this supplement to market. It was such a win-win for us, she says, because it was a way to really serve our customers, and at the same time get our people in the field excited about working with us. Those people in the field, Lauren and her team were hitting the road almost every weekend, driving up and down the East Coast, hoping to attract like-minded folks with a computer and a decent dial-up connection. There was no money in the budget for airline tickets, so they gassed up the car in North Carolina and pointed themselves to any metropolitan area within a day's drive. Some weekends, they made it all the way up to Boston and back. It was exhausting, Lauren says now. We were always tired, but everybody's tired when they're trying to succeed. That's when most people quit, but we knew success was just around the corner. Their Thermochrome launch was a big hit. Market America ended up selling $60 million of the stuff in the first 18 months. So I guess maybe big is an understatement. Really, it was huge. And by the time the manufacturer and the reps had been paid, there was a foundation left on which the business could grow. That $60 million, we were afraid of it, Lauren says. We were afraid to spend it, didn't know what to do with it. All we did was put it back into the business, which of course is what you have to do when you're just starting out. But in our case, it was because we didn't trust it, all that money. We found new products and invested in them. We found new salespeople and invested in them. And the more we found good products and good people to help sell them, the more our customer base grew. That goes back to the proof of concept we talked about earlier. Only here, Market America was a business of so many moving parts that the company needed to build on a bunch of different successes. Not only that, each rep had to build up his or her brand with his or her own customer base. And since Lauren envisioned a sales force of thousands, these building block elements were key. After Thermochrome, Market America's next big hit was Isotonics, which is still the number one vitamin on the market. The cool differentiator with this product is that it comes in a powdered form you can mix in water, kind of like Alka-Seltzer. It delivers the vitamin directly to the bloodstream, a revolutionary product at the time. Product by product, the company was able to build its brand. And this, too, is what happens when you operate from a place of broke. One success leads to another. And if you trip up along the way, one failure is not about to break you. If anything, it forces you to work even harder to make sure you don't follow up one misstep with another stumble. Know where you're going. Now, jump ahead to today and you'll see a whole different enterprise built on this same foundation. The company acquired the domain name shop.com a couple years back. So now the Market America brand has sort of migrated over to this new name, which really shines a powerful light on what the company is and what it does. Deliver the most complete, the most compelling shopping experience for its customers. Along the way, Lauren has transformed her own personal brand to become one of the world's most respected fashion consultants. She's created an award-winning cosmetic business, a luxurious skincare line, and a collection of fine jewelry, and she continues to seek out innovative products with the goal of improving the lives of her loyal customers. She's also built up a star-studded network of celebrity friends who regularly endorse shop.com products on their social media posts. And on the back of all that, she counts more than 3 million repeat customers in the shop.com database. Those sales reps Lauren worked so hard to recruit on all those road trips, there are now over 180,000 shop consultants beating the drums on the company's behalf, generating over $3.8 billion annually in retail sales. And get this, more than 400 of these individuals have become millionaires. So clearly, Lauren and JR were onto something with this weird concept they had all those years ago. I love that you're talking to people about this concept, she tells me when we sit down to talk about the theme of this book, because I don't think we would have made it if we didn't have to struggle in the beginning. It helped us to refine our pitch. It helped us to think carefully about the products we selected and developed. And it helped us to stick to our business plan, even when other people were telling us it just wouldn't work. This right here is a great example of the power of broke, because Lauren and JR found the freedom to pursue their vision in their empty pockets. They had nothing to lose, everything to gain, in a long line of folks they were determined to prove wrong. Powerful motivation, don't you think?
Lauren's key shark point, do your homework. In the early days of Market America, Lauren devoted most of her time to researching and developing new products. I love learning what people spent their money on, what was important to them, Lauren says. What she found was that her customers were eager to spend on products and services that would make them feel better and look better. The same is true today. That's why Shop.com has devoted most of its attention to health, wellness, and beauty products, and why Lauren has emerged as an impeccable style leader. The idea behind Market America's online business model might have been a gut instinct. But the company's runaway success flows directly from Lauren's research in this area. She knows her stuff, she knows her customer, and she knows what works. Do you trust your own instincts enough to move your ideas forward?
6. Be the change. This happened. I was at the South by Southwest conference in Austin, Texas in March 2015. I was there for the vibe, the excitement, to pump up some of my businesses. If you've never been, the conference is a killer mashup of music festival, movie festival, and think tank. Austin's a great city to begin with, and when you add South by Southwest on top of that, there's an electrifying amount of energy. There were a lot of events going on all over the city, and I was drinking it all in, meeting some interesting people, connecting with this dynamic group of artists and entrepreneurs, and critical thinkers. The highlight of the conference, for me, came about in an after-hours way, away from the main event, how it usually goes at these types of things, right? I was invited by my friend, Gary Vaynerchuk, to attend one of his famous jam sessions. Gary's a well-known social media visionary and one of the most creative, forward-thinking entrepreneurs I know. And every year he puts together this wonderful collection of people who gather in a private setting and exchange ideas. That's all it is, really. And it's the most amazing thing. There's no agenda, no objective, no set guest list from one year to the next. Just a chance for Gary to reach out to all these interesting folks in all these interesting fields and get them together in one place to talk about interesting things. I was thrilled to be invited. So I raced up to this private suite at the W where the jam was supposed to take place. It was late on a Friday night, around 10 o'clock, maybe 11. Gary wasn't there yet, but I went with my director of business development, Ted Kingsbury, to see what we can see. When we got to the suite, there were maybe a half a dozen guys just waiting around. Then, a half a dozen more. For a couple of beats in there, it felt to me like we were being pumped. Because this didn't look like any kind of powerful get-together or meeting of the minds. Soon, the place started to fill with top executives from companies like Uber, Yik Yak, Twitter, Product Hunt, and Meerkat, a bunch of angel investors, some venture capital folks, my buddy Tim Ferriss, who you had a chance to meet a little earlier in these pages, in all, a couple dozen game changers just kind of hanging around this one suite, anxious to gaze into the future together. To get the benefit of our shared perspectives. Sounds like a pretty cool gathering, huh? Anyway, I was all over it. The way these things work, there are no cell phones, no computers. Nobody's taking notes. The rule is, there's only one conversation going on at a time. No crosstalk, no interruptions. And for the most part, what we share in terms of ideas, forecasts, whatever it is we're talking about, it's meant to stay in that suite. Matter of fact, I'm breaking ranks a little bit just by writing about it here in this book, but I cleared it with Gary beforehand, so we're good. I told him I wanted to let my readers peek behind the curtain to see how big ideas get kicked around in this kind of setting, and he was down with that, agreed with me that it could maybe get an even bigger conversation going. Meanwhile, we were still waiting on Gary, the guy who'd brought all these folks together in the first place. There was a lot of confusion over who else was coming. Where we were supposed to be, all of that. Somebody mentioned that the night before the neighbors had complained to hotel security about the noise level. So as soon as our group reached a kind of critical mass, we got a call telling us to keep it down. At first, I caught myself wishing I'd been invited to that party, but this one was also off the hook, in a different way. And it's not like we were making any real noise, wasn't any kind of wild gathering. There was no music, no crowd of people. But I got it in my head that we'd be better off meeting in a conference room downstairs. So I raced down to the lobby to see if I could arrange something. I told the manager what was happening, but for some reason, he wasn't able to hook us up right away. Around midnight, I finally got this guy to set aside a room for us. But when I went back upstairs to tell the group, I couldn't find anybody. I'd been downstairs a while, but I couldn't think where the group would have gone. Then I heard them. Almost whispering, all the way in the back of the suite. Gary had arrived by now and gotten things started. and they'd moved the conversation to the bathroom. Yup, people were sitting on the tile floor, on the sink, on the closed toilet seat, in the tub. It was a strange scene. Granted, it was a giant bathroom, the kind you'd expect to find in a luxury suite. But it was still a bathroom. I took a look around, and it just seemed crazy to me, all these visionaries, all these influencers, all these fearless, mega-wealthy entrepreneurs huddled in a super-sized bathroom trying to keep the noise down on this informal jam session. Why the bathroom? Simply because it was about as far as our group could get from the wall we shared with the complaining neighbors in the next room. So these guys were just trying to be considerate. So there I was in the middle of this unlikely scene, like something out of a Marx Brothers movie. All of us crammed into the bathroom like that. But what was really remarkable about this moment was what these remarkable people had to say. Gary started working his way around the room, asking each of us to weigh in on the future of technology, commerce, communication, whatever it was that was lighting our imaginations. He'd put out a question or pose a problem, and we'd take turns answering it, addressing it. The basic theme of our time together in that bathroom was that the world was changing, faster than any of us could have imagined, but at the same time, not fast enough to keep up with our imaginations. If that sounds like a contradiction, it's not. Here's why. At one point, Gary polled the room and asked us to reflect on what the future might look like in 5 years. When I had the floor, I talked about the rise of e-commerce and the fall of conventional retail outlets, the brick-and-mortar stores that have controlled the way we shop for goods and services for generations. To my thinking, it's one of the biggest revolutions we're facing as a society. But even as I put it out there, it sounded like an old-fashioned idea. I mean, we're already seeing this shift. We're deep into it, on a global level. The space between online and offline purchases gets smaller every day. So these geniuses and visionaries didn't need to hear from me on this. And then the guy next to me said something that blew me away. He said that in 15 years, there'll be a way for us to drink data and knowledge. The same way we can now download information from a flash drive onto our computers. And by drink, he meant there'll be a special formula or cocktail or additive you could put into your drink to help you, say, learn Spanish. Or maybe U.S. history. Or how to change a flat tire. I heard that and thought, damn, I'm a little out of my element here. We were a room full of tech nerds, entrepreneurs, and visionaries. And as I sat there on that bathroom floor, it became clear to me that everything we were talking about, everything we were imagining, every innovation we were anticipating, they all came down to one basic element, one commodity we were all in the business of selling. Time. Actually, this only became clear to me once Gary Vaynerchuk summed it up for us in this way. That's how out of my element I was with this group. Think about it. Time is the one thing money can't buy, and yet we're all out there selling it, one way or another. And if they're not helping us maximize our time, or save it, or spend it wisely, companies are selling us a good time, an easy time, a memorable time. Financial service companies are helping us avoid an uncertain time. And Miller Beer tells us it's 5 o'clock somewhere, Miller time. Time. You can't give it away and you can't take it back. But at the same time, we've got all these brilliant people spending their days trying to find a way to monetize it. What is Uber, after all? It's a ride service designed to save you time and money. Apple Pay. A way to help merchants and customers make seamless, cashless, frictionless transactions, ultimately saving them time. Grubhub, a way to order food and get it delivered to your home faster. Every innovation Jeff Bezos is trotting out over at Amazon, they're all about time. Our economy has become a race to deliver goods and services faster, more efficiently. Just look at how time has been compressed and repackaged in the evolution of social media. Facebook took all of our friends and all of our friends of friends and put them in one place so we could reach out to them and keep tabs on them more easily. Not only that, they started telling us who we might want to add to our circle, saving us the trouble of going out and actually making new friends ourselves. After that, Twitter came on the scene and shortened our interactions to little soundbite comments of 140 characters or less.